The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hello there, I'm Chris Difford and welcome to the podcast I never thought it would happen, made in collaboration with the wonderful charity Help Musicians. I first met my next guest on a railway station in London, Clapham to be precise. We were there to promote the Squeeze single Up the Junction. He was then working with a guy called Keith Autham, who was his mentor. He went on to then work with Rod Stewart, Bob Marley, Mick Jagger, and David Bowie. Of course, there was the Spice Girls and many others, David Beckham. The list goes on. I've always been in awe of him, and I have to say he's never changed. He always looks so young, and he's such a sweet man. Please welcome Mr. Alan Edwards. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Chris Gore. I love your place.
It's my writing den.
It's very, very colourful. It reminds me, for some reason, of that Neil Finn song, Always Take the Weather With You. And he wrote about that room, didn't he? And I think in New Zealand or something. That's what probably. I would have imagined it to look like. Full of curios, like you've been sailing around the world on fantastic trips and bringing things back, which I suppose you have, really.
Oh, so have you.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing I brought back was a Burt Lancaster poster. Sweet smell of success.
The sweet smell of success. We love that smell.
Have you ever seen that film?
I haven't seen that film.
It's
no, is it brilliant?
Fantastic. It's the best film about PR ever made.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's incredible. And the person that got turned me onto it was Bowie.
Right. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he said to me one day, he said to me, Alan, are you related to Tony Curtis? And I said, what do you mean? He said, could you be Tony Curtis's illegitimate son? I'm just wondering. And I'm going, well, I don't think so. He said, but I've seen Sweet Smell of Success and you're in it. So I didn't know what to make of this. So I went and got the film on DVD, and it's this really dark film on Broadway. It's like film noir, and it's all about this sort of PR that's ducking and diving and doing dreadful things. And one of the best moments comes in it when he wants to sign up this jazz band that are playing on Broadway. So he kind of sets up, he goes in to meet them, and what he's done, he's having a thing with the secretary in the newspaper office. So he's read the following day's newspaper articles. He's read a review of this jazz group who've never been heard of. So he goes down to where they're playing quickly that night, bursts into the dressing room, says, guys, do you want a great review? I can arrange it for you. Do you want to be in the New York Times tomorrow? And they were going, wow, this is amazing. We've never had any coverage. You know, how you can't do it. He said, oh, I can do it. He said, get me the phone. He picks up the phone. He says, get me the editor now. I want the editor. And suddenly this, you know, whatever. And he says, this is what I want. This band are fantastic. I want this review in the paper tomorrow. And he dictates. He says, yep, no, I want it like that. And I want the words like that. And I want it laid out on page 38. Da-de-da, and slams the phone down. Of course, the next day, the guys see it. They're so knocked out, they hire him on the spot. And I used that stunt, actually. Some years later, I was in a meeting with Shep Gordon, who was the manager of Alice Cooper. And Shep, you probably met, a wonderful, larger-than-life character who had one of the greatest management rosters ever. He managed Raquel Welch, Groucho Marx, Alice Cooper, and Teddy Pendergrass. I mean, talk about a strange mix.
And Squeeze.
And Squeeze, of course.
For an hour.
And you'll remember him with the Hawaiian shirts and the Smiths. So we're sitting in this meeting in the boardroom at Sony, and it's an Alice Cooper meeting. And in those days, we're talking early 80s or something, people in record companies still wore suits and things
that. You can imagine?
Like Paul Russell with a sort of pinstripe suit and a cigar, and it was all really straight. And there was Shep lounging out on the seat with a spliff on the go. And they didn't know what to make of him. And anyway, the campaign was no good, you know. And Shep said, "This is the worst motherfucking campaign I've ever seen in my life. This is a disgrace. I'm going to take Alice off the label." And the whole room went dead quiet.
Oh my God.
Just seen this film, Sweet Smell of Success. So I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to have a moment. So I stood up. And I said, "Let me fix it." I walked across the room, picked up Paul Russell's phone, and did the whole thing. I said, "Get me the editor now. I want the editor of The Sun on the phone." And like, so then I played this whole thing. I said, "Yep, I want a review in there tomorrow. I want Alice Cooper, the most important artist, fantastic new album. And I want it in there tomorrow. Okay, understood?" Slam down the phone. And Shep says, "My God," he said, "at last in this country, someone with red blood." You know, and the whole meeting, you know, it was incredible. And I had to rush out of the meeting and call my mate at The Sun on the column and say, "Look, do us a favour. I really need a big favour. I'm begging him, could you get this a piece on this bloke Alice Cooper in tomorrow?" And it all worked out. And as I always remember, as I was making the call, I could hear the talking clock, and it was going, "The time, according to Accurist, is 4:03 exactly." But it worked. But I don't know when David said this thing about Sweet Smell of Success, because after I watched the film, I kind of thought, I'm not sure what message you were sending me there, David.
Have the newspapers changed over the years? You know, like in those days, you could make those kind of phone calls. Today, there's sort of, you're more driving people's PR towards the social media world, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the newspapers haven't changed, but the whole world around it has changed. I mean, I occasionally feel like the PR was the gatekeeper, but now I feel like I'm the gatekeeper, but there's no fence. So it's quite tricky because it's coming at you from all different directions.
So well put, yeah.
And they're very driven by social media. I mean, when I first started putting stories out, largely they'd be triple checked, maybe. So if I rung up and said there'd been a fight in a pub and whatever, then often they'd send down a journalist. Now, nothing's checked at all. It's so quick. It's taken, you know, down online. So something like the Mail Online, they're picking up a story that happened seconds ago. It's posted online.
Mm.
And the papers are really following what's going on in social media. So in one way, it's different because it's like a lot of spinning plates and you've got no time. I mean, when I started, if someone put a story to you, they'd say, "We've got a story that your client's done this, that and the other. Could you let me know tomorrow morning? Or if it was a Friday, could you call me a Monday and confirm or not confirm?" So you'd have a weekend to sort of deal with it. Now you've got 5 minutes if anything crops up. So it's so fast. But I still think that fundamentally, a good PR is a storyteller.
Yeah, of course.
So I don't really care what the mediums are or whether it's, you know, whether it's Instagram or whether it's the Daily Mirror. It's all the same, really.
Yeah. But of course, you know, you don't have acts like the Rolling Stones and Bowie anymore. You don't have those kind of caliber of artists to go to the Observer and say, we want a double page spread on the Sundays.
You just don't. And I mean, talking about the Rolling Stones, I mean, for me, that was just such an education because I'd out of punk and I'd learned a lot. And of course, I'd worked for Keith Olsen before that, which I'll come on to in a minute. So even by then, I knew a lot when I got hired by Mick and Keith in 82.
Yeah.
But this was the top level working for them. And I remember they did a press conference to announce the 82 tour? Big European tour. And they decided Mick was so clever with his marketing mind, always wanted to do something different. So instead of a West End hotel, he said that, "I think we'll do it in the Beach Road in Soho. That'll be cool." So You know, for the journalists, this is quite exciting. Soho's still edgy then. It's still strip clubs and all kinds of madness. And so you're sort of going into the beach. And there's all these great characters. David Wigg, you'll remember some of them. Judith Simons from The Express. All the sort of Bob Hart, all these legendary people. I mean, the flipping, some of the columnists had monocles and things like that. It was a different world. But they're all in this club. And of course, I'm the Rolling Stones PR.
Yeah.
I don't know half these people because I only know Fred Bloggs on The Enemy or something. Or Tony Stewart on sounds. So it ends up with Mick introducing me to all the journalists and saying, this is our PR and this is what he'll be doing. And it's supposed to be the other way around. But it sort of followed on from there because I learned an incredible amount about PR and the sophistication and the planning. But back to your original point, and it applies with David, and I think it applies with all these incredible acts, iconic acts that are going to live forever and are going to become holograms and go on into the future. The difference with them and a lot of artists you see now is they lived it.
Yeah.
I mean, something happened. You know, when I worked for both of those two, Bowie and Jagger in different ways, every day there was an incident, there was a drama, something happened at an airport, or there was an argument, or an incredible gig, or someone took some drugs. I mean, every single day. I mean, the phones never, ever stopped.
Yeah.
Now, of course, everything is so tightly controlled.
Mm.
And I mean, I work with some, you know, some really big acts, but you have layers and layers of management and then lawyers and advisors. You get 30 people on a call.
Yeah.
On an email thing. So nothing spontaneous happens. And I'm at an age where I've got lots of grandkids now. And they find out about music through all kinds of different ways. And they'll get something on TikTok or they'll see it in a movie.
Yeah.
And they'll say, Granddad, we've heard Jimi Hendrix. He sounds really good. Is he on tour at the moment? and you kind of have to explain. Or Joni Mitchell, they'll come up with things that you don't expect. And I say, what is it you really like? And they said, well, we love the stories. They got up to these incredible things and, you know, dressed in funny clothes. It was all mad and unpredictable. And, of course, that doesn't happen now. And I think that means that some of these people won't go down in history. They may sell a lot of records and make a lot of money.
Yeah. It's a different
business.
We
won't be doing podcasts about them in 100 years from now.
I'm sure not. It astounds me. It's just a different lifestyle, really, I think. And you know, someone like Mick Jagger, he's an incredibly smart businessman as well as an incredible performer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to train himself to move around at 81 years old on that huge stage is extraordinary, really.
Yeah. Oh, he's a fantastic businessman. I learned that pretty quick. Mick was doing a promo tour, I remember. I can't remember what it was for, but he did it presidential style. And he was going around Europe. We were doing 3 or 4 towns a day. So we'd fly into Dusseldorf, fly into Amsterdam, fly into Hanover. And in each of those places, he'd want from me a dossier, who the local journalist was, what the football team was, who the main politician was, was the album stopped, which songs were being played on the radio, all of that. This was pre-social media days. So you couldn't just Google it.
No.
You had to ask people. I mean, luckily, I always got on really well with journalists.
Mm.
So I had a mate on the Frankfurter Allgemeine or the Hamburger Morgen Post, or I had mates everywhere who were helping me and giving me intel.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mick would want dossiers. And if he was doing, David was the same. If they were doing an interview, he'd want to know who was doing the interview, what their last 3 or 4 pieces had been. You know, I don't know, were they married? Did they have dogs and cats? I mean, you'd literally provide that kind of service. And it's fantastic, really, because it keeps you, not only does it keep you on the top of the game, but it means the interviews are brilliant. And they used to, both Mick and David loved doing interviews. They treated them as an art, not a chore.
Yeah, and I mean, the only person I've read about recently through my friends at Universal is Taylor Swift. And apparently before she flies into the country, she has to have a dossier of absolutely everybody who's going to be in the room and, you know, who she's been having cups of coffee with. I mean, it's a philosophy in a way, isn't it?
It can get out of hand, though. I was working for a really well-known act a couple of years ago, American act, I won't say who. There was a sort of whole dossier and you mustn't talk to the artist and only speak if you're spoken to and all this kind of stuff, right? And we'd arranged a press conference event in Hanover Square at a club.
Oh, yeah.
In the afternoon and a playback and all the rest of it. And even though I'm hired, I still haven't spoken to him.
Mm.
And I went backstage to the toilets and I'm standing there in the urinal and I look next to me And the star standing next to me doing the same thing. And I thought, I better not say a word. And I never did get to talk to him, even though we repped him. So that's taking it a little far.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, when you were a teenager, what attracted you to music? Was there music in your house? Were your parents big on music?
No, not really. It must have been in my DNA or something. I mean, yeah. First love was football. I was football crazy from a young age. So I was going to matches, reading match reports. I was very into newspapers. And I don't know why, because I wasn't a newspaper type family, but I used to buy... I think because I used to play for the school team. I used to have to travel to games. I used to buy all the papers and read all the matches. About 11 or 12 or something, I guess it was Radio Luxembourg or, you know, and the Roscoe and all that. And then, of course, it was Caroline. Mm-hmm. I was still very young and I'd have the transistor under my, you know, under my pillow before I went to sleep when I was supposed to be doing my homework and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the signal, especially with Luxembourg, we've heard about this, it did used to fade in and fade out.
It did, I remember.
And you'd be
it,
hearing the Beatles or the Love Affair or, the, you know, the Archies or whatever. And it was kind of cool because it was phased. It gave it an extra sort of vibe. So I soon knew every song out there and who played it. And of course, you'll remember, it was very hard to find out because you didn't, again, have access to it through a computer. You'd have to buy music papers because the national papers didn't cover it. So there was this big thing. And when you discovered the Melody Maker and the NME, it was like finding the Bible, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly you knew who played what. And of course, when you started buying the albums, and I couldn't afford complete albums, so I'd buy compilations.
Oh, yeah.
There was a great one on Ireland, or I'd buy Trojan Chart Busters. I'd buy whatever, you know, and sort of get to learn about these bands. And you'd read the sleeve notes forensically and you say, oh, they recorded that at this studio in New York and he was the bass player.
Yeah,
It was just became your religion, didn't it?
Yeah, it did indeed, yeah. What was the first band that you went to see as a teenager?
Oh, I can remember it. Atomic Rooster.
No way.
Atomic Rooster. And they were playing. I saw them at a place at Worthing Pier Pavilion. And I went there. I had a greatcoat because you had to have an army greatcoat.
You did.
And I had a copy of Led Zeppelin 1 that I used to carry under my arm at all times because it was the look.
It was the
And
look.
The hair, obviously, was reasonably. And I sat on the floor at this gig, cross-legged. And I remember being really impressed that Cole Palmer played a 45-minute drum solo.
Did he?
Can you imagine anything more horrendous? But it seemed like the most brilliant thing I'd ever heard at the time. But to be fair to him, he then did go and join Emerson, Lake and Palmer and became a big star. But, yeah, that was my first one.
Yeah, I saw Atomic Rooster at the Lyceum Ballroom. I think it was Chrysalis. Used to do these free gigs on a Wednesday afternoon. And I think they were supporting Genesis.
Right.
And the talk in the bar was about Carl Palmer having the biggest bass drum in the world.
I wondered what you were going to say for a second. I thought we were going to do the Paul Young anecdote, but maybe not.
We'll leave that one out.
I went to see, weirdly, Richard Desmond, who I work for a lot. He called me up about 6 months ago and said, Alan, it's Richard here. Atomic Rooster are playing The Forge in Camden tonight. And so I went down to see them thinking, oh my God, what's this going to be like? They're actually really good. I don't know if they've got any original members, maybe Vincent Kane, but they were kind of just a really good blues rock group. Better than I remembered.
Did you ever have to have sort of face-to-face arguments with journalists before or after interviews with people like Bowie?
Well, there was a lot of arguments around the Stranglers. I remember that.
I can imagine.
Which was a slightly different thing because it was normally the Stranglers had a very full-on approach to journalists. I remember there was one writer from The NME, they didn't like the review, so they invited her out on a Portuguese tour they were doing. And after the gig, they tied her up to a tree and left her there. I mean, there were many incidents involving the Stranglers. It became more serious than actual arguments. There was another gig at Aylesbury Prior, somewhere like that. This was a Jean-Jacques moment.
Oh, God.
And he'd asked me to meet a journalist in a pub. He was going to come along for an interview in Covent Garden or something. Anyway, we get to the pub and then JJ's or the Strangler sort of mob, the Finchie boys, turn up and kidnap the journalist. He's taken to the gig and they tied him up to a chair.
Oh, no.
And they lower him onto the stage before the band come on.
Imagine that.
I mean, the journalist gets out of the ropes, runs through the audience and comes back with the police.
Wow.
So those media relations were pretty difficult. It was never quite that hairy with David or the Stones.
You know what I loved watching was the Blondie documentary that you were involved in. I didn't know you were that close to them, and it was a beautiful kind of synergy that you worked with them, because they not only were they hugely successful, but you worked with some really lovely people.
Yeah, I mean, Debbie and Chris and everyone in Blondie were really, really great people. And I bought the first album on private stock as an import. In those days, you could buy them from, I think it was Our Price and Tottenham Court Road, and they cost quite a bit more. And you could get things like Television, Talking Heads, stuff that hadn't come out here. And I got that first Blondie album. It was just so different, because it was kind of 50s, really. You know, it had this sort of really great West Side Story rock and roll vibe to it. And, of course, the image was fantastic. So I went to the gig at Dingwalls, their very, very first ever gig. And that's the one where I knocked on the door and said, "Can I be your PR?" And Chris Stein looked out and said, "Yeah, what do you want?" I said, "Oh, I'd like to be your PR." And he just looked at me, and he looked back in, went back in the dressing room. And as you know, that dressing room at Dingwalls was about 10 foot by 2 10, foot. You know, it was tiny. And I heard him say, "Debbie, this kid wants to do our PR." And then about a minute later, Debbie looks out, and she's still toweling down, you know. And she just looks me up and down and says, "Okay, yeah, he'll do." That's how I got hired. And then I hadn't known the other part of the story until I saw that BBC doc where it was mentioned. Chris said, "Yeah, well, he looked like Mark Bolan." And Debbie said, "Yeah, that's why we hired him. It was a no-brainer." So I got the job for looking like Mark, not my PR skills.
Oh, no.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Benny Busy. I'm proud to be one of the thousands of artists supported by Help Musicians. I am a singer, a rapper, a songwriter, a producer, and a mentor. I kind of grew up in a very chaotic space, and for me, music was my first taste of, I guess, maybe like freedom and belonging, because I was just used to like survival mode in different spaces as a little kid. So it was where I felt kind of safe and I could process all the stuff that was going on. It gave me a sense of community and purpose. Michael Jackson, Whitney Houston, church music, grime, a lot of music. I'm quite like that anyway, like I'll get bored easily. I don't latch onto one person. I feel like it does need to be a combination. It's just the way, even the way my name, Benny Busy, comes from. I need that multi-sensory, like, that it's just the way I am. So it's a mixture of pop music, R&B music, grime music, even a bit of Nigerian music. I don't know what you call it, but it's an energy. I don't know, almost supernatural. Didn't want to go there, spiritual, but yeah. I remember listening to a lot of Michael Jackson, funny enough. But I guess it's because of the videos. Just seeing someone so free and so expressive. And then even people more locally, like your So Solid crew and Oxide and Neutrino, your grind guys. Even Dizzy Rascal, he had that grit. He had that hidden undertone, that emotion of like the pain and all the suffering and all the stuff they were going through, and it was like you could hear it in the way their music came across. That's where I saw myself, you know. To have released 10 EPs, like when I look back on that, that's a big deal for me. Like, because it just shows that I'm alive, like I've been living, even though like I've had my share of suffering and adversities and stuff like that, and health, you know, issues and setbacks. I feel like to still just keep pushing forward is like, that's a big highlight for me, to look back at that catalogue and be like, wow, you've had the support from radio, you've had your music on television. In fact, that was one of my highlights, because I was about 16 or, I don't know, maybe 18, when I had my first song on television on Channel U. And you can imagine, you know, being around school and just the neighbourhood and people going, right, like I saw you on TV the other day. It's the mini stardom kind of thing. So it was like a bit of a pat on the back. Something you're doing is working, and keep going kind of thing. So that was a big highlight. Also being nominated in 2014 for the Urban Music Awards. Sometimes you kind of just think like, no one really sees what you're doing. You're just kind of pushing and pushing, and no one's really hitting you up saying, I see you. So it was quite cool to be nominated twice as well. And that was alongside like Ed Sheeran and Getz and Big Nasty and yeah. And then recently I've been mentoring on the Help Musicians Ivors Academy scheme. That's been really cool as well, to just kind of have a mentee and use everything I've learned to give back, and use all the lessons that I've learned to give them good advice. And I really enjoyed it, and there was a sense of fulfillment in that, you know. It was quite cool to let him make his own mistakes, just because, first of all, anyway, he was someone who had a lot of ideas, and yeah, he had his own kind of vision, and I could have come in and been like, no, this is what I know that works, do this. Everybody's experience is different, so I had to be open and just kind of leave room for all those mistakes and that trial and error and experimentation. That was a good way to approach things, and I got to learn a lot from that as well, seeing another artist do things with their own unique, authentic approach to their artistry and their experience, yeah. For the last 3-4 years, there's been a lot of surprises, doing things that I didn't think I would be doing, you know, yeah. With Help Musicians, their support has been more health than music related. And the way they supported me was for mental health support. It was while I was burning out and having, yeah, just a lot of difficulty and waiting for the NHS or just different professionals. You're just on a waiting list and you're just waiting while, you know, obviously in real life, things are really happening and like, you know, they're really struggling. And I think it was the timing that they were actually able to support and get me in with a counselling session. And then that literally was what started, you know, the right course of treatment and course of action that would actually just set me straight, set me back on track to continue my, you know, career in music and to keep pushing, you know. And yeah, that was very helpful. That was very helpful. Definitely is cutthroat. You do need a lot of resilience, and thank God that I actually do love music, because imagine if I did not like it and I was just doing it for the, you know, what I would get in return, I think. But my support system, funny enough, I've been saying this recently, but it's my goddaughters, it's my nieces, my nephews. Like even yesterday I spoke to my goddaughter, and just like that 20 minutes of just a FaceTime with her, like it does so much. It makes such a difference. That's what's kind of really helped me, to be honest with you. It just softens the blow of like the heaviness of trying to make it, you know? And then just my own practices as well. Like I feel like you do have to almost self-lead and self-manage and self-diagnose and kind of self-structure your life to survive. And I've just, over time, tried a lot of things, and I've reflected and I've reviewed and I've taken what's worked the best for me, what keeps me good, and I've just tried to make sure that those are now embodied habits that I try to use every day. Like today was a good day. Like today, like it's gonna sound so simple, but this morning I was able to stretch, get up and stretch and do some movement. I was able to make myself a bagel with a honey roast ham and some boiled eggs and have a cup of tea. That's like a successful morning for me in my world. Like, you know, maybe that's a strategy for me. And then I might go for a walk later to decompress. And even just that, even to gain understanding about how I work, how this body, this psyche, this mind, this human being works. Like I've had to really figure out myself and learn myself, you know. Now I have some answers, you know. And I promise you, help musicians are not paying me to say this, but this is from my own lived experience. Musicians coming up, you are privileged, because when I started music, I didn't know of no help musicians. I didn't know about Music Minds Matters. I didn't know about Music Support, FAC. I think definitely reach out to help musicians if you are a musician and you have needs of health support, career support, music advice support, you know, and financial support to an extent as well. Just ask. It's okay to ask for help, and you can start with like the people close to you, and then you can extend that further to organizations and, you know, health services and etc. But I think just getting into the it's okay to ask kind of thing. I don't know if this is to do with being a man. I don't know if it's to do with being a musician. And a lot of my friends will say the same thing. We don't ask. We don't want to bother anybody. And we already have a presumption that they're not going to help. But I think maybe if we take out the emotional bit and just see it as a tick box and just ask, and whatever happens, happens, you know? Yeah.
Help Musicians is a charity for working musicians across the UK. To find out more about the support they offer, why they do what they do, and how to support them in creating the world where musicians can thrive, visit helpmusicians.org.uk or find them on social media today.
Was Keith Ortham a huge mentor to you? I remember when we first met, he was very much on the scene.
Yeah, without Keith, we wouldn't be sitting here today. I mean, He was absolutely instrumental. And he was kind of like a father figure to me as well as a PR. And he took me really a lot under his wing. And I was quite a handful, to be honest. I just get into a lot of scrapes. One day I was posting about football, so he invited me down to play for his local team, Epsom Rovers or something. And so I get there and I've done a load of speed before the game. So the first half, I'm all over the pitch. Then obviously second half I collapse and nothing happens, you know. So Keith was always like kind of having to get me out of scrapes and stuff. Some of them are probably we shouldn't go through.
Yeah.
Go into here. But it was quite old school, Keith, because he'd been the features editor of The Enemy, but he knew Fleet Street and he was a normal guy, you know. Mm. You will remember him, of course, and he used to drive the Green Jag. And at the end of every day, he'd sit down and he'd kind of talk to me about life, you know, and he'd give me a sort of thing. And he'd say, Alan, have you ever read Ernest Hemingway? And I go, well, not really. He said, well, try, you know, The Old Man and the Sea or whatever. And then he'd talk different writers. And then he'd talk about a bit about philosophy and he'd talk about PR. So I learned so much from him. And of course, I learned how to be a proper PR. I remember he gave me day one, because he believed in throwing you in the deep end. Day one, he gave me a list of things to do. Mm. It was handwritten on a bit of paper on my desk when I sat down. It was like, always return journalist calls, you know, always, you know, find out what's in the newspapers. And it got to the most important point last. And it said, when you're buying drinks for a journalist, always get them half pints. But if the client's buying you a drink, always get a full pint. Part of the instructions on how to be a PR.
That's genius. Of course, you wouldn't do that today.
Keith was very careful, you know. So he sent me out to take a journalist out, I can't remember, Beat Instrumental or something, to talk to John Entwistle at his house in Ealing.
Oh, yeah.
And John had the biggest collection of guitars, imagine, when he bought the house next to him, and I think the house next to that, and knocked them into one, all these semis. Mm. And it was just a guitar museum.
Mm.
And I remember I had to take someone out. We did this very sort of, spent an hour looking at the guitars. Anyway, I came back on the bus from Ealing Broadway to the office in Victoria. I said, oh, Keith, you know, can I have the money? It's cost me 7 and 6. He said, well, where's the ticket? I hadn't got a bus ticket. He wouldn't reimburse me. I mean, it wasn't glamorous, but funny. I mean, in Keith's office, because he represented all the most famous people from the Woodstock generation.
He did.
You know, Moody Blues, Eric Burden, The Who, everyone. And it, working in the office was unbelievable, because the office was a tiny little room, 3 telephones and a bookkeeper called Claudine, who used to come in a few days a week. Mm. And most of it was me and Keith.
Yeah.
And, you know, some days you'd be sitting there and Eric Burden would be sitting next to you talking about what it was like playing with war or, you know, the animals or Chas Chandler walking. Keith was very sort of conventional guy in a lot of ways, you know. And he'd go out every lunchtime for half a pint and a cheese roll every day at 1 o'clock.
Amazing.
I mean, it was fixed, you know.
Yeah.
So he's gone out one day and there's a knock on the door and in walks this chap, top hat, tails, you know, monocle, the whole bit. And I realise it's Keith Moon, and he's got a cane. Mm. And he comes over to my desk, and he taps on the desk with a cane. He says, my good man, can you tell me where Mr. Altham is? And I said, oh, well, Keith, you know, he goes out at 1 o'clock every day for half a mile and a cheese sandwich. And Moon looks at me imperiously, says, oh, does he? And then he walks over to Keith's desk, which is about 6 inches away from mine because it's a tiny one. Flips it up in the air. Everything's smashed on the floor, coffee cups, papers. Comes back to my desk, taps, and he says, tell Keith I called me. Walks out, and I'm sitting there thinking, what do I do, you know? About 3 minutes later, Keith Altham walks through the door, nonchalantly opens the door, looks around, the office is wrecked. And he just says, oh, Moon's been in, has he? And hangs up his raincoat. This is pretty weird. That is a normal day.
But the things that Keith installed in you and taught you in some ways, are they things that you pass on to the people that you work with in your office now about receipts and...
Absolutely. No, not receipts. I'm not that type. But the discipline of PR.
Discipline,
I mean, the serious things like returning calls, like really knowing the story. And then Keith took me up and down Fleet Street, which in those days was, this is like mid-'74, '75-ish.
Yeah.
And it was like you see in the movies. It was people running around chatting, hold the front page, you know, with visors and big sort of rolls of newsprint. And you'd go in and meet the editor at 11 in the morning. You'd open a bottle of scotch. And that's before the drinking started, you know, which would be at lunchtime. And I was the kid. So Keith was teaching me the top level. These guys weren't... You know, they were giants. If you were the editor of the Daily Express or something in that time, you were practically running the country.
Yeah.
And they're all big guys with booming voices. And
yeah.
Keith taught me, you know, it was a very far cry from sort of punk rock or something like that. He taught me how to deal with those kind of people. And I've tried to instill the lessons, which are really simple. Being straightforward, never lying, exaggerate maybe, but, you know, and do what you say you're going to do. I tried to instill that in everyone who's ever worked for me, and that must be hundreds of people by now over the years.
Of course, indeed, and a lot of people that you've mentored have gone on to do their own thing, which is testament to the love that you've passed on. In those days, well-being, you know, things like the Help Musicians website wasn't really a thing, but it is now. It seems like well-being on tour, having a therapist and, you know, there's less drug taking as far as I can tell. It's a completely different kind of place to be now. Do you witness that when you're going to see people?
It's incredibly different. And I pass my mind back even to into 80s, 90s, certainly 70s. But you go on tour and I remember, you know, you've done this more than me and you're in these places, it can be so lonely. And that was pre-social media days and pre-mobile phone days. So if you were in Denver on a Monday night, you were like on the moon. You couldn't call home. You couldn't speak to anyone. You didn't know anyone. It was always a horrible room with a multicoloured sort of carpet, which was horrendous, and the room service had stopped. And I'd get very, very depressed, very lonely. You know, it was like a mental sort of thing, and you would have really needed therapy, even though you didn't know. And the only therapy that everyone had was going to the bar and having another drink. I mean, I saw... You know, Stuart Adamson, because I co-managed Big Country with Ian Grant, and they were a great band, and we toured a lot. But Stuart just didn't enjoy touring, really. He didn't want to be on the road. He was a gentle soul, brilliant, brilliant writer, great artist. And we didn't kind of realise it then, but he would suffer from depression on tour. And there was no question. If you said, should we get a therapist or someone to help you, they'd all think you were... you know, completely wet, you know, it's like everyone would take the piss out of you. It was unthinkable. Now you look at it and it's so much more humane and better organised, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in my sort of darker period and David Enthoven took me for a cup of coffee and he said, did I want to write lyrics with Brian Ferry? And I said, I'd love that. That'd be a dream come true. And he said, well, what about stopping drinking first so that you could go in there with a clear mind? And I thought, oh, actually, I don't want this job. And then he said, look, you know, Bowie, you know, look at what Bowie's and the Elton Johns of this world have done. They're going to meetings, they're cleaning up their act, you know. And I thought, oh, sod that. But actually, with a bit of thought, it was like, oh, yeah, actually, there is a different world.
Yeah.
So someone like Bowie was a real influence for me in that place because the first time I met him, was on the Ziggy Stardust tour, and it was a different set of rules then.
Yeah. I saw him on the Ziggy tour. I didn't meet him. And then I saw him on the next tour, which was it. I saw him in America because I was managing Hazel O'Connor, and I went out to LA, and we happened to be staying in the Sunset Marquee, and David was there with the whole entourage. I mean, they'd taken over the whole hotel. Mm. And man, it was like something out of a movie. Stuff that was going on, you just couldn't quite believe it.
Mm. Yeah, but he was a massive inspiration in the same way that Elton was. You know, they would kind of go to meetings and kind of light up your life in a different way.
Well, David was an inspiration to me in hundreds of ways. I can't even sort of assess it. But I mean, I remember when he'd stopped drinking and he'd really suddenly had all this extra time, and he was very alert, and he'd be up early in the mornings, and he'd be reading even more books. And I would get calls on tour. He'd sort of come and see me at 6:30 in the morning to talk about the press. And you go, oh my God, you know, it's like, and sometimes it wasn't always great press, like on Tin Machine or whatever.
Oh yeah.
But I learned so much from him. And when I first really went on tour with him, Serious Moonlight, 82, 83 sort of thing. And he'd often talk to me. He was a bit like Keith in that way. He'd often talk to me about books or art or films and, you know, and he said, you should go buy that book. And then I'd buy it and I'd read it and then I'd let him know. And then maybe I'd recommend something different.
Mm.
As a person, and as you will know, he was very kind, very thoughtful, very funny.
Mm.
He was, I'm sure subconsciously, he's probably the most influential person in my life, I suppose.
So it was a big loss when he went. It must have been huge for you.
Yeah, but, it, you know, people say, I saw a piece the other day and they said, oh, your friend, someone said to me, your friend David Bowie. He wasn't my friend David Bowie. I worked for him.
Yeah,
and it was a privilege. Yeah. Sometimes it was really hard work. He was fiercely intelligent. He'd be forensic on the detail.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'd want to know when this interview was going to run and was it going to be on the front page. So I must have had a deep relationship with him, especially at times. I felt almost like related to him sometimes, which sounds odd, but it wasn't like being a friend, because there are other times where you're quite almost semi-dispensable. You never know, because people would find, they'd say, David Bowie called and we were best friends. And then 6 months later, he never, ever called again. He could be quite like that. And people ask me, well, how did I survive so long? And I was sort of, it's like a sort of moth in the candle and flame, just in a way. You've got to know when to keep your distance too,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What a great moth you are.
Yeah, so my jumper's a bit moth-eaten. But I think at the end, I had a call from Coco, who you will remember, and Coco said, oh, David really wants you to come out to New York and hear the album. And I thought, okay. And that happened really on every album. He'd say, just come out and listen to it. What do you think? And the rest of it. This time, I said, oh, yeah, I could be out in about 3 weeks. I've got blah, blah, blah. She said, do you think you could come any sooner, like about 2 or 3 days? And I thought, wow, David must be really very excited about the music here. This was Black Star. So I went out and I went down to Electric Ladyland Studios that you all know in the Village. And I think Coco was there and then she went out. It was just me and David in that big studio, in a big studio room. And he was sitting there on the settee watching The Good, The Bad and The Ugly. Now, this is like 9:30 in the morning. It's quite strange. Played me a couple of tracks, but he was really watching the movie. And then he started talking about 60s and he started telling me some really funny stories about gangsters and stuff in Soho. And so I started matching him. I said, oh, I've got this funny story about when I played football with Bob Marley or when I was working with The Who and some bloke walked in with a, you know, whatever. And we spent a couple of hours just trading these stories. I mean, really, like, so intimate and so special and so close. And then Coco walked in and we walked down on the street. I remember it was a clear blue sky day. And I can't remember if David gave me a hug. He said goodbye. And that was it. And he died a couple of months later. And that was his way of saying goodbye to me. So even now, I don't really know what the relationship was.
Well, he had huge respect for you, obviously. Well,
you never know. I always think when you work for people, you just can't assume anything, can you? But, I mean, it's hard to think of a greater star than David Bowie in the real sense of the word.
Absolutely, completely. So you've just finished your book.
Mm.
You must be very, very proud of it and pleased.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited, but I'm also nervous. And I read a review in Mojo yesterday. It was really nice, first review, and it was really good. But they said something like, I can't imagine why a PR would actually want to write a book. And I thought, oh, my God, no, nor can I. Why have I done this, you know? So, yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking, but I'm, do you know, it's not so much proud, I'm more relieved, because there's so many great stories and so many different people that appear in it, and also things, it's not just war stories, because I talk about things like, you know, talk about racism in media, talk about Leveson, talk about Paola in America. So there's other stuff. And I just feel, well, there's been some incredible adventures, and I'm glad I've got it all down in paper and it's preserved and it will somehow be there and whatever. People will see it sometime in the future. So it's more a relief, actually, to have just done it.
Yeah. And have you done the reading bit? Have you done the audio side of it yet?
Yeah, I did it a couple of weeks ago, which
is hard work, isn't it?
It's really hard work. I'd noticed on Amazon it was already advertised. It said you can order the audio. And I thought, well, I've done the audio. What if I got really nervous? What if I lose my voice? What if I've got a cough? What if this? And I did find the first day I hadn't slept well for some reason the night before. I think the dog had been barking or something. And I was, you know, when you're not really, I wasn't quite on it. And they're very tough, you know, because it's like, oh, no, you do that sentence again. Oh, no, that word. And we've all got words we can't pronounce. Mine is phononymous.
Phononymous.
I spent age about 10 minutes phononymous. And he was going, no, do it again, you know. And it was really hard. The second day, there was a journalist or former Daily Express journalist who was in the studio with me. And he was almost part of the stories. And somehow it just flew by the second day.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that.
And who's doing the PR?
Oh, it's great. It's a lady called Emma Finnegan, who's very, very nice. And she's a really great book PR.
Oh, yeah. It's a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, she's done some really good authors and she's lovely. So I'm enjoying it. But of course, being who I am, I try not to second guess anything she does. I think we've got a great rapport.
And finally, is there an artist that you haven't worked with that you'd love to work with or would have loved to have worked
with? Yeah, there's lots, but they all died annoyingly. I mean, I would have loved to have worked with Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Some of the adventures there, you know.
Can you imagine?
There's a guy called Maloney who did a book I read about last year, and he'd been Frank's PR. And the book was called Get Maloney. And he told some great stories, but there's one about they went to Chicago in his private jet and it was a meeting with the mob. And it was the real, you know, real Gambinos or whoever, you know, the real sort of family. And Sinatra didn't like it. It was too heavy and he wanted to get out. And he said to the PR Maloney, he said, look, I'm going to slip out the back door. Can you handle this, please? And suddenly this poor PR guy is dealing with the heaviest mobsters in America. A funny book, but I looked in the background. I tried to get in touch with him, but he's 96 years old. So I thought, God, you left that late.
Is late.
But Sinatra would have been great. Hendrix would have been lovely. Although I kind of feel like I work with Hendrix because Keith did.
Yeah.
And he told me so many lovely stories. And sort of Hendrix sort of was omnipresent in our office. So I almost forget that I didn't do Hendrix's PR, that Keith did it. I tell you, I'd like to have done Handel's PR.
Wow.
Because I love the music, but I love his life. He was very London.
Wow.
And he was ducking and diving around London, sticking up a poster, having a meeting with a promoter. And it was like there'd be a new king. So he'd knock off a couple of sort of quick songs for the king, you know, Welcome the King, the fireworks suite. So it reminded me exactly of ducking and diving around in the punk days or something. He would have been great.
That would have been, what a great film that would. Yeah, he used to hang around in Berwick Street or something?
Yeah, all over. And he was one of the theatres down in Haymarket, and he'd be like a normal music person. That one's a hit, that's a flop, better write another one, you know. I mean, it was exactly like it would have been in the 70s or 80s. He would have weirdly fitted in punk or something.
Right.
So I'd like to work for him.
Hendrix and Handel.
Of course, they lived in the same house. And it's now a museum, which is quite cute if ever you're walking up and down Bond Street and you've got 5 minutes. I think it's a free museum. I've been in there. They've done it very nicely. So Handel lived downstairs and Hendrix upstairs, I think, and they've got quite a lot of the artifacts. It's great.
I'll have to go and check that out.
It's really charming.
Alan, so are you. Thank you so much for devoting this time to the Help Musicians podcast. It's a wonderful charity. They've been going for 100 years, started by Edward Elgar, one of his violinists didn't have any money, family didn't have any money, they couldn't bury him when he died. So they all clubbed together and it became the charity that it is today. So it's an extraordinary thing.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Really wonderful.
It is wonderful, yeah.
What a great place to start from, Elgar.
Yeah, my God.
Wonderful. Pretty good.
Pretty good.
He's another one. We'd like to do his PR too.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Chris, I enjoyed it immensely, and we went off on all kinds. I made loads of copious notes before we did it, and we didn't touch on them. We went off on all kinds of great tangents, so it was lovely.
Thank you very much. I could have spoken to Alan for absolutely ages, and in fact, I might do that, go and have lunch with him, because that's what grown-ups do, they go and have lunch. It's amazing, but you have to read his book. His book is fabulous. It's full of detail. It's beautifully written. And if you want to know more about Alan and the PR world that he has lived in all of his life, you've got to read the book. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.